There's a meeting you're going to attend in the future, a possible future, in which you're going to wear a scientifically advanced, incredibly snazzy piece of clothing from Ministry of Supply that was sent straight to your door. It's going to be the most amazing shirt you ever had on. And when people see you walk into that meeting, they're going to turn and look and go, this person knows what they're doing. Ministry of Supply offers a new generation of dress clothes using innovative materials, advanced manufacturing, and timeless aesthetics to help you feel comfortable at work all day. I'm wearing one right now. They sent me a shirt and it is unbelievable. It stretches, it moves, it's a second skin. I love it. All Ministry of Supply clothing is machine washable, wrinkle-free, climate controlled, soft and stretchy, and sustainably made. Get $10 off your first purchase of Ministry of Supply's scientifically better clothes by visiting ministryofsupply.com and entering the code YANSS. That's you are not so smart. YANSS. And just go to ministryofsupply.com and check them out to see for yourself. They make some really cool clothes, so the future you wears clothes from the future. Supplied by ministryofsupply.com. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 163.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the added perks of writing a book on the science of meetings is I have found that the meetings I attend, they're much better than they used to be.
That is Dr. Stephen G. Rogelberg, who is a psychologist and an organizational scientist who studies management, organizations, institutions, how people work together in groups. And he has written a book about his lifetime pursuit, his study over the last 20 years, the centerpiece of what he works on day to day. This is a scientist who studies meetings, and he's written a book called The Surprising Science of Meetings.
I feel like people are kind of, they feel a little extra pressure. I definitely find that the meetings that these are not the meetings I'm leading. So the meetings that I'm just attending, they have gotten better.
That's a great, I mean, this may be a tip that you should have included in the book that if you want to have better meetings, invite me. Now you probably hate meetings. Most people do. Stephen told me that over the last two decades of his research, people often tell him that they feel like that's all they ever do at work is sit through meetings. And that's actually true of a lot of people. He's found that the higher up you go in an organization, the more meetings you will likely attend every day. For instance, many of the CEOs he has interviewed tell him that about 5 to 6 hours of their workdays, 5 to 6 hours, are spent in meetings. And you've likely spent many of your waking hours desperately waiting for a meeting to conclude, or you've attended a meeting about having meetings, or a meeting about having fewer meetings or better meetings, and much of this awfulness all feels inevitable or unnecessary. But his research has shown that neither of these conclusions are true. Meetings are only bad if we make them bad, and they are not something that we can just do away with. They're crucial to the cohesion of any institution. So, he wrote a book about how to use his research and the research of others to improve the meetings in any organization.
So,
how do you study meetings? Like, before we get into the details of your book, what are some of the methods that, and if you could, as far as your career goes, like, how long have you been doing this and what are some of the ways you do it? I'd like to just hear a little bit about that.
Well, I've been studying meetings and teams for over 20 years. And so obviously quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of different ways of studying it. I've administered surveys to people, where they talk about their days before it happens and they talk about the meetings before they happen. I survey people at the end of their days where they reflect back on the meetings that have occurred. I've surveyed people and interviewed people right after a meeting to kind of capture those experiences. I've even had people keep diaries where they maintain records for over 5 days that say about all their meetings and also how they feel about their day and their job attitudes. And then we've even conducted experiments where we bring people into a kind of a lab setting where they have a meeting. And we videotape it and we can watch it and we can manipulate certain things. So, for example, we've done a study where we manipulated lateness to meetings. Mm. So we could really kind of quantify what are the effects of on a meeting when it starts late. So there's lots of different modalities that can be applied to kind of understand this.
I love this. I love this so much because we often think of science as lab coats and petri dishes and telescopes and lab rats, but scientists study every aspect of the natural world. And when you learn there are scientists who study meetings, those times that we get together in boardrooms or over video chat or on conference calls or even just coffee, it reminds you that everything we do is part of the natural world. It's all part of the interaction of atoms and molecules and physical forces that scale up to things like PowerPoint presentations and weekly department head check-ins and so on. And there is a wing of science called organizational science that studies these sorts of things. And they've been studying them for a long time.
I mean, if you step back for a moment, the question is, how could we not study this, right? If people are spending so much time in meetings, and they're so incredibly frustrating. It is just a perfect opportunity, right? Because you ideally, as a scientist, you want to study things that matter. And meetings are having a tremendous effect on humans. And there's so many of them. So I was really drawn to that.
And the numbers are shocking, at least to me.
So some of the best estimates that I've seen suggest that there are around 55 million meetings a day.
I love numbers like that. 55 million every day. Every day. That's every single day. That's not like in a week. That's there was 55 million yesterday. There'll be 55 million today. I love the idea of that. For some reason, it makes me feel like I'm floating above the planet and I see it, you know, like I'm the idea that of all these interlocking social systems and phenomena that are taking place from, you know, and all these natural occurrences, the oceans doing their thing but also traffic flowing and then, you know, ants building nests, all the things that are happening in that mix are human beings getting together and doing this thing that we've created. And there are 55 million occurrences of that happening every single day. And it feels like there's just at any given moment, if you just slice the human experience, like make a cross section of it, what you would find is that we're all in a meeting. I just love the idea of that.
I agree. I write in some of my articles the idea that meetings are windows of into the very essence of an organization. That if you could just do that slice, as you note, you will learn so much about the health and effectiveness of an organization. Meetings are the building blocks. And that's why in my book and my various talks, I don't suggest that meetings should be eliminated. Meetings are essential. Meetings are critical for communication, cooperation, coordination, consensus decision making. Right? Organizational democracy in many ways takes place in meetings. So the elimination of meetings is a false goal. What we really want to do is eliminate wasted time in meetings. Mm-hmm. And to just think differently about meetings, try to elevate that time. Think about how can we make sure that we've honored people's time in meetings. And there are definitely ways of doing that.
How to improve meetings where you work or anywhere else using the science of meetings. Using the evidence gathered by psychology and sociology and organizational science and all these other wings of social science and beyond. That's what we're going to talk about in this episode, right after this commercial break. Have you ever heard the phrase, you don't know what you don't know? Well, the Great Courses Plus is the perfect place to fill in those gaps in your knowledge, to start knowing what you don't know. And then once you know that there are things you don't know, use the Great Courses Plus app to know those things. See, learning does not stop with this online streaming service. I mean, it doesn't stop. It can't stop because there are thousands of lectures on virtually any topic, all presented by top professors. You can dive into things like the human brain, nuclear energy, pirate wars, playing guitar, the philosophy of Tai Chi. It is incredible, all the things they have in their database of courses. And in each course, you get a lot of lectures, sometimes 30 or 40 of these things, each one about 30 minutes long. There's a whole history of knowledge and ideas and history to explore. And the Great Courses Plus app makes it easy to watch or listen anytime, anywhere. Here's one that I think you'll like. This is one of those courses that I just love it so much because it's something that I have struggled with my whole life. It's called The Power of Mathematical Visualization. You can discover the advantages of seeing math from an entirely new angle, guided by a teacher, Professor James Tanton, PhD. Now, what you get here are 24 lectures, each one 30 minutes long or more, that show you all the ideas in mathematics visually so that you can understand them intuitively. You get the power of math as a picture, visualizing negative numbers, ratios, extraordinary ways to multiply, area and formulas and place value and decimals and fractions and infinities and probability and Pascal's triangle and randomness and Fibonacci sequences and graphs and statistics and fixed points and quadratics. This is something you really should get. I mean, if you do the free month that you're going to hear about in a second, this is one of those things that'll just completely change the way your brain makes sense of reality. I highly recommend it. Expand your mind. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus right now. And for a limited time only, my listeners, people listening to You Are Not So Smart right now, can get an entire month for nothing, for free. You get a month to put as much in your brain as you can when you sign up today using my special URL. The URL is this, thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. Type that in, go to the Great Courses Plus, sign up, and just start gobbling up knowledge right now. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. Smart. And now we return to our program. My name is David McRaney, and this is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. In this episode, we're speaking with Stephen G. Rogelberg. He is a professor of psychology and organizational science, and he's written a book called The Surprising Science of Meetings. And we're talking about The Surprising Science of Meetings. I love that idea that so that your book is not about, hey, meeting, because this is where, that was my approach. When I first picked up the book, I was like, finally, somebody's going to say, we shouldn't have any more meetings. That's a side conversation I've had several times too, which is the idea that like meetings are a waste of time. In fact, you actually quote people in the book who are like famous people or people who have been at the head of organizations who had that opinion as well, that we should just get rid of meetings altogether, that they are in a world with email and Skype and Slack, that there's no need to actually see people face to face. If you could just address that idea for a second.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's a world without meetings is much more problematic. I mean, really, if you think about the evolution of meetings, right, it came out of, you know, this initial belief that all decisions and, you know, should just be exercised by the boss and the boss's boss, and people were just pawns to be told what to do. But our models of organizational effectiveness have changed. Like, we've really come to believe that organizational greatness is beyond just a great person making all the choices, that by leveraging the talent of those around you, by promoting these synergies, unexpected and amazing things can happen. Through inclusion, you get wonderful things. By involvement in meetings, you get people committed to what was discussed in the meeting, so that they persist more readily. And when they come across a roadblock, they become more creative in trying to figure out how to get through it. So, you know, so basically, the meetings, I think, are, it's a recognition of human potential. And, you know, it's a recognition of, I think, what organizations can be when they leverage their talent most effectively. So I absolutely believe that we need meetings, and that if we didn't, it would be really, really, really bad for the human experience of work. I understand why the critics say what they say. I get it. But I feel like a bad meeting is a symptom of a person who doesn't know how to lead the meeting. It's not just a symptom of the meeting in and of itself.
I can see where lots of people who don't like meetings think that all meetings are like the meetings that they're in. And then instead of thinking we can improve this, they think we should just get rid of this because this is a terrible idea. Well, how did we ever get started doing this? This is some tradition that needs to go away. And then the people leading meetings who think when the meeting goes bad, they don't think that meeting went bad because I'm not good at this. They think this meeting went bad because meetings are bad. And then another aspect is all of us being so unhappy with meetings suggests that we all share this idea that they're that this is just an evil that we have to deal with in life instead of it being something that can be fixed. So we said how many meetings everybody has, 55 million in a day. About how many meetings does a typical person have a day?
It varies based on the type of job you have. Mm-hmm. And so what's, we've had data that suggests, you know, that people have around 7 meetings a week, kind of on average. But I think the data that are more compelling is that when you look at people who are leaders, and we can find that leaders spend between 50 to 75% of their time in meetings.
Wow.
So clearly everyone is having some level of meeting activity. But as you move up in organizational hierarchy, that activity just continues to expand.
And as you say in the book, the higher up you go in the hierarchy, the more meetings you have until eventually it's just, you know, my job is to have meetings all day because I'm the person exactly. telling everybody what to do or keeping up my tabs on the company. If you're the president, it's just meeting, 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 meeting. And definitely. Yeah. And if all your meetings suck, then you will think, wow, right? My life, half of my life is doing this thing that's terrible. How much money do we spend as a nation on meetings? Like, and how is that calculated?
So there have been some statistics that have been generated. So you can definitely cost out meetings, right? We know the cost of each and every meeting we attend in terms of direct dollars, right? By looking at the time and the individual salaries, we can cost out a meeting. So some organizations have done estimates and suggest that 15% of your entire personnel budget is basically going to meetings. Uh-huh. And this is a tremendous number. This is a tremendous number because this is actually, that line item doesn't exist on any budget sheet, right? So can you imagine any organizational expenditure this large that actually isn't noticed? And so that's kind of a local index. And then there's some other data suggests that as a country, it equates to around $1.4 trillion a year in activity. But but in so many regards, these costs are underestimates. You know, if you're costing out a meeting, yeah, you can identify the direct costs, but there's so many indirect costs, right? There's opportunity costs, right? There's, you could have been doing something else, and that something else could have been, you know, much better. Then, you know, there's the cost of the frustration. There's the cost of being, you know, feeling disengaged. There's the cost of the room and the travel time. So you have, and there's the cost of not being available to your customers. And then there's even something that we found in our research called meeting recovery syndrome, MRS, meeting recovery syndrome. So this is the idea that when we have a bad meeting, we just don't leave it at the door. It appears to stick with us. And it seems it goes with us, and we ruminate on it, and we often co-ruminate. So we need to make sense of the bad meeting. We have to talk to others about our bad meeting. So that's more wasted time. And if you really reflect, we definitely all do this, right? When we have a bad meeting, we definitely have to talk to others about it. And it definitely sticks with us. So that there's another set of costs.
This is an enormous amount of money and an enormous amount of time. An enormous amount of our lives are spent doing this. It's like the next thing after sleep, it seems like. We generally don't like how they work. And yet they are essential to having the modern world that we enjoy. So it seems that we should do something about it using science as a way to do that. And scientists like yourself who've been studying it for 20 years is a better way to go about solving problems, in my opinion, than just throwing opinions out there. So I'm following the order of your book. One of the problems we can tackle first is the length of meetings. The science has a lot to say about that. I'll just let you go. You have some suggestions in the book about how to handle how long a meeting should be. What are they?
Okay. So I'll just keep my comments focused on length. So basically, think about the typical meeting length and how long do you think it generally is?
Most of my meetings are scheduled for an hour, although they go over right. A little bit.
Okay. So yeah, most meetings are scheduled for an hour. And there's no magical reason for that, right? That tends to just be an artifact of our calendaring system. And that's just not a good reason to establish a meeting time of an hour, especially given something called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is this idea that work expands to fill whatever time is allotted to it. So if you schedule a meeting for an hour, magically it will basically always take an hour. So we can use this to our advantage, right? We can schedule meetings for less than an hour. And if you schedule a meeting for, let's say, 48 minutes, likely it's going to take 48 minutes. So the best practice is for a leader to think carefully about what truly needs to be accomplished in that meeting and how long should it take, right? So make a choice, make a decision. And in fact, once you make a decision, I encourage that meeting leader to dial it back a little bit, add a little pressure. The psychological research shows that when you add a little pressure to groups, they tend to be more focused and actually perform more optimally. So I like the idea of leaders, you know, being purposeful, decide on a meeting time, and, you know, really making it a thoughtful decision. I don't have any problem with a meeting starting, you know, 14 minutes after an hour. I have no problem with a meeting taking 35 minutes. That's all fine. People will appreciate it. They'll be curious, which is fine because they're just like, oh, what's going on here? They'll love the idea of having time returned to them. And also when your meeting doesn't fill this whole calendar block, one of the things that you're doing is you're allowing them to get to their next activity on time.
That's insane that we don't... It's not factored in that we just the lag between the two meetings. If the fact that we have back to back meetings and the idea that there's no adjustment period even included into the planning, it almost feels like people are like, well, what are we supposed to do? Meetings last an hour. I mean, you know, this can't be changed.
I mean, I know. Yeah, you're right, and it's really funny because our entire socialization in schools. Like, we're led to believe that intervals are a good idea. Like, we're led to believe that you actually do need time to get to your next activity. And so we know this. This is not some crazy science. Typically organizations aren't doing that. And so, you know, I've definitely found that that's low-hanging fruit for organizations to do. So a lot of organizations who have leveraged the book, you know, they stopped defaulting to an hour or 30 minutes, that they basically changed their defaults to 25 and 50 minutes. And that's certainly a good start. I want even more intentionality in that, but still, I love that as a good start.
Yeah, yeah. Intentionality is the big theme of the book. Like, hey, you know, you can change this. Hey, you know, you could think about this a little bit, maybe. You know, you could make it better. You don't have to just like lay back and take the fact that meetings happen. There's a way to we can change all this. We could paint this place, you know, purple if you want to. We can do whatever we want. You know, we can have meetings. We can do a meeting where everybody has to wear a funny hat if we want to. We can do what we want.
That's right. Like, you know, intentionality is just so critical. So even when you think about, when you think about the research, there's no magic formula to make a meeting great. And there's no magic formula to anything, right? This is when you think about self-help books and weight loss books. You know, when we think there's a magic formula, it's never sustainable. These magic formulas are just not a thing. And it's just, it applies to meetings too. So, you know, but when you get people thinking and making choices, it's just going to be a better collective experience. And we can all find pieces of our lives where we are intentional, and we know that there's benefits, right? You're intentional, you, in designing this podcast, right? We're intentional if we're hosting, you know, a party. We're intentional every time we meet with a customer. Like, we're intentional in so many phases of our life. And intentionality doesn't even take us that long. It could take us just 30 seconds to a minute, but we're thinking through it, because we don't want that person to leave our party or our meeting with our customer saying, oh my gosh, I really wish I wasn't there, right? That's an unacceptable thought. But when it comes to like meetings with our peers or our direct reports, we just don't have that same level of intentionality. We don't inherently keep embracing that steward of others' time mindset.
You also mentioned the Parkinson's law and the Yerkes-Dodson law. If you could talk about those two things just a little bit.
So yeah, Parkinson's law is really that idea that work expands to fill whatever time is allotted to it. Yeah, they've even had research where they kind of videotape groups' activity as they proceed through this timed experience. And basically, groups don't even really start working hard until they hit that halfway point.
Mm.
So there's definitely those anchors of how much time a schedule has a big effect on us, and how we approach and the urgency we bring to that task. And the Yerkes-Dodson is really an inverted U. And what they find is that performance and pressure kind of have a positive linear relationship. So people seem to do better with pressure, but then up to a limit, when the pressure gets, or the stress, or it gets too high, then it starts to negatively impact performance. So you want to find that midpoint. So that's why moderate, reasonable levels of pressure tend to result in the most optimal performance.
Yeah. So there's also another thing. Forgive me if we already mentioned it, but the don't, even after you reduce the time of meetings, if you can avoid having back-to-back meetings, you suggest that maybe we should do that. Is that another thing?
So that's a different thing. You know, this is leveraging research on interruptions, that we know that when humans experience a host of interruptions, that it tends to have a negative effect on them. It has a negative effect on their well-being. It has a negative effect on their productivity, right? Because that task switching can be a concern. And so we've started to do research around this topic of trying to look at the optimal scheduling of meetings. And really what our hypothesis and our theory is that we need to design people's days so that they do have periods of time where they are unscheduled, where they have uninterrupted time, where they can get into flow, right? Where they can accomplish their creative tasks and just be fully present with lots of interruptions. So if that's the case, then, you know, where people kind of have their meetings, you know, I'm okay with back-to-back if all the back-to-back meetings, in a sense, are all done at in a kind of a finite amount of time, right? So it's not back to back throughout the entire day. So if you were kind of giving me my perfect meeting cadence for someone scheduling meetings, I love the idea. They get to work, they have time to do their thing, kind of get wound up, you know, respond to emails, address some pressing tasks. And then I like the idea of a meeting before lunch, because we know lunch is going to be an interruption. So I like the idea of a meeting before lunch, and I like an idea of a meeting after lunch. Right. So now you kind of have this middle block of time where you've had this meeting activity, but it's not interrupting you anymore. And then after that post-lunch meeting, then you get back into flow and hopefully, you know, finish your day feeling like you've done both individual success and you've had collective success.
Hmm. So what about huddles? How does this play into these other ideas that we've just presented?
Yeah, so huddles are this idea of a quick, speedy meeting, 10 to 15 minutes. And huddles are designed to build alignment, right? They're analogous to, let's say, American football, where everyone gets together, has a huddle, calls the play, they scan the field, they make a decision, and it's all about the here and now. And I love it. I think that's a great use of a huddle, is to get a team aligned. But the thing with a huddle is that sometimes people have them go too long. Like, huddles should never run long. Mm-hmm. They need to stay tight. That's why I even love the idea of it just keeping it to 10 minutes. And I just want huddles to be that quick conversation at a predictable time. Everyone's available. I think in general in the morning, it's a good time. But if it's just 10 minutes, then I don't feel it kind of takes you out of your flow. It just, you get the benefits, that alignment between the team, you know, what is the most pressing issue of that day. And then for those topics that are more meaty, then what I suggest is that the team, they park them, right? They put them into a full meeting that's designed to talk about those more strategic issues. So overall, I love this idea of this cadence of these quick meetings to really avoid the need for meetings, but these quick meetings to get people on the right page, and then, you know, more substantive things where you can kind of, you know, talk about those issues that sometimes just keep getting tabled.
Yeah. So this sort of covers length. And I think that's a big part of the whole thing. Cause I know when we start to check, everybody checks out at a certain point, starts playing with their phone, especially if they're not engaged. But another reason for that is not just the length, is because the meeting wasn't planned well. We've talked about that a little bit, and this is a big part of the book. In fact, the title of this chapter is "Agendas Are a Hollow Crutch." So, what do you mean by that? And if I'll let you just sort of speak broadly about agendas, and then we can dig into anything specific.
Yeah. So one of the things that we find in our research is that having an agenda is really not all that predictive at all of meeting success. And if you really stop and think, that's really not much of a surprise, right? People tend to recycle a lot of agendas. And what matters more is not having the agenda, but what's on the agenda. Is it really compelling? Is it compelling to the people you invited to the meeting? Did you ask for input into what that agenda is? And then most importantly, again, if you really think about it, it shouldn't be a surprise, is how you facilitate those agenda items. You know, did you involve others? And was it a meaningful discussion? So those are the topics that really matter. And that's why I titled the chapter "Agendas Are a Hollow Crutch," because if you open most meetings books, they always start, have an agenda. And I don't hate agendas. I think agendas could be awesome, but just having an agenda is not enough. And right. The problem is so many meeting leaders think that, oh, look, I'm a good meeting leader. I had an agenda. And like, that is just false.
I get this. I get this mentality because I feel this way all the time. Like I have a plan, therefore everything's worked out. Or I've written out what I'm going to do today, which means that I am very organized. Or I organized all day long, which means I am very, like, just because you did the thing doesn't mean you did the thing well. And arranging folders on your desktop doesn't really equal productivity. But I get it. It feels, you do feel better. So I used to really enjoy when I had to lead a meeting, writing out that agenda was the coolest part to me. I was like, I'm making this agenda, and it's going to look cool, and I'm going to send it to everybody, and we're going to follow it, and it's going to be orderly. But, and that, that, I mean, it didn't matter. If you don't do it right, then it's going to still lead to weird things. And you mentioned all these different ways that agendas can be done improperly or poorly or can lead to poor outcomes and how to fix that. You say if a topic doesn't require, I think this was huge to me. If a topic does not require interaction, it should be handled in another medium. And I feel like that is a lot of what people complain about when they say, why didn't we do this as an email? This meeting could have been an email, that kind of thing. If you could talk about that.
So if you're going to have people there, ideally you want some interaction. I mean, that's just, it just seems like that's kind of intuitive. So now, if your agenda is all just information, there are clearly other ways of doing it. You know, especially in this day and age, right? You can just film yourself on your phone. You can talk into your phone. You can just send yourself talking about this issue to everyone, and then people can listen to it at their leisure, right? They can listen to it on their commute. They can listen to it in a way that doesn't interrupt them from their current flow. And other thing is they can listen to it a time and a half. Right, because we tend to be able to listen faster than most people speak. Mm-hmm. So there's just different ways of thinking about it. But even if the meeting is just going to be information-based, we can approach those more creatively. So for example, if you're going to have people just, let's say, report out on some information, all right, give them time limits. Say you have 1 minute to report out and hear and give people the same structure so that everyone kind of knows what to do. And then put a timer up. Right, make it into this game where people are like prepared and they're giving you that 1 minute bullet and it's awesome. And so it's extremely efficient and you have a little bit of that entertaining component to it. And then I'm also a really big fan of leveraging silence for update meetings. This is a practice that you can find often at Twitter, where bring folks together for an update meeting and then on the screen you have a Google Doc. And basically everyone is doing their update as a paragraph live in the Google Doc. And so you see this update document being created. In a sense, everyone is speaking at once. The updates are done, and then everyone's going through the doc. They're reading it. They're adding comments. They're making notes. And you've had this lively, interactive, wonderful discussion, but it's all silent.
You talk about the silence a lot, too. The silence happens a lot in remote meetings. I used to do a lot of phone call meetings. You know, call in and type in this number, and you'll be included in the conference call, and then we all wait, and everybody gets in there, and we share our things. In fact, I have one of those today at 1 p.m. So sometimes those are great, and sometimes those are not. You mentioned something, though. When I worked in a job at a desk in a building with a bunch of other people, when I had my conference call meetings, we all had to press mute. That was the first thing. And you always knew who didn't have the mute pressed because you could hear whatever they were doing. And then you would hear them... you know, you'd hear them doing not the meeting, of course, eventually. In fact, I always loved when people would be like, hey, how you doing? Oh, nobody good. Well, you know, I got this stupid meeting. And like, mm-hmm. You can hear them talking over me. So everybody mutes, one person talks. And I started almost immediately to play on the internet or to do some other work that I actually needed to be doing. And I have more than once gotten up and gotten something to drink and come back to sit down. And I started thinking, I bet everybody's doing this. And I bet there's a chance that this person is talking to no one, that everyone on this meeting is actually doing something else. And this person has become like a plant in the room. It's like a construction work taking place outside the window. There's just noise now. What do we know about all this?
Remote meetings. Those are tricky ones. I'll share a quick little piece of data. If I did a survey and I asked people what is the most dysfunctional way of meeting in terms of just not being highly effective, mm-hmm. the remote meeting will emerge as the number one mm-hmm. Thing. But if I ask people, which meeting do you most prefer to attend? They will say the remote meeting.
All right.
and you know, and it's clear that it's so they can multitask and they can do other things. And that is obviously not a good statement about remote meetings. So remote meetings certainly require more care and more attention. They are definitely much more tricky to execute.
What about meeting like we're doing now, we're having this conversation over audio. I don't do these with video because I find video meetings, there's something mysteriously bad about them in when it comes to interviews. But I'm not so sure when it comes to if I was trying to organize things within my institution. What do we know about the difference between audio only, like phone call meetings, versus these new technologies like Google Hangouts and Skype and so on?
Right. Well, it comes down to, in many regards, this concept of social loafing. And social loafing has been proven in the science. And basically, it's the idea that we reduce our efforts when in a crowd. Mm-hmm. And the more people that are there, the more we reduce our efforts. And it's just something that appears to happen. But one of the ways of countering social loafing is kind of identifiability. To the extent that your efforts are known or can be kind of, you know, made known, you tend to not reduce as much. So when we're having a meeting, when it's audio only, then we are just ripe with social loafing. And it's different than your context of an interview because it's just two of us. Like, we can't socially loaf during this conversation. We have to be present. But if there was 10 of us, like if your thing was, I'm going to interview 9 meeting experts, yes, then there would definitively be social loafing going on. And so when it's just audio only, you don't have this identifiability, and one of the best ways to create the identifiability is to switch to video. And videos then now create this new level of accountability. The other thing that leaders can do is just keep calling people by name. So even though you have video, you still get in the habit of, you know, using people's names all the time. And then I also like the idea of a meeting leader kind of keeping track of who's talking and who's not. And that way, if they can say, hey, Jane, I haven't heard from you for a while. What do you think about all this? You know, Gordon, any comments? So they are just fully dialed into the facilitation.
That's really good. And what about mute buttons? What do you feel about that?
So this has gotten me in trouble.
I was wondering why you skipped it.
Yes, this has gotten me in trouble. But So I have a whole chapter in the book about remote meetings. And one of the things I talk about is this idea of banning the mute button. And while I don't mean you should always ban the mute button, I do see the value at times. But think about what the mute button does. If you did ban it, what would people have to do? They would have to pick a quiet place to have their meeting. They would have to not walk their dog. They would have to not load the dishes. They would have to not eat their sandwich, right? They would have to be fully present in a quiet place. And this is exactly what we expect of those at work, mm-hmm. right? We expect people in the work, physical work setting to have those standards. So why don't we have those standards when people are attending remote meetings? So I love this. I love the idea of challenging the team to be able to position themselves that the mute button is something that no one truly needs because everyone has been thoughtful on where they're attending this meeting. Mm-hmm. And the meetings are not bloated in size and they have compelling agendas. So people feel like they don't want to be, social loafing and just, you know, not present.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, but there's one last thing I want to ask you about, which is this is so cool to me. I know that your book has more important things in it, but this was my favorite thing just because it involves hidden psychological levers that affect our behavior, and that was seating, because you talk all about, you even have a chart like an illustration, and you talk about what will happen if a person sits here or here, and I would love to hear you talk about that for a little bit.
Sure. Well, what we know is that seating location does have an effect on your experience of the interaction, right? So, you know, for example, people sitting at the head of the table tend to emerge to more leadership roles. People sitting across from one another tend to experience a little bit more disagreements. People sitting next to each other actually tend to have more agreements. So there's something about seating location that just matters. And we we can definitely, I mean, this is not a hard finding for us to understand, because we know, I mean, when you're sitting at dinner, when all these things, seating location affects information flow. Well, none of this is a problem in of itself. But the fact is, if the seating location is identical meeting after meeting after meeting, it just suggests that you're not potentially reaping the entire benefits of all the potential interactions and communication flow.
Yeah.
So I just like the idea as a way of keeping things fresh is for people to change where they sit at times. I've seen this executed with a meeting leader having name placards, and every time you walk into the meeting, you're kind of sitting in a different location. It's kind of fun. It's different. And it definitely changes that communication flow. So it's just another example of a small decision that can bring energy to a meeting, that can change communication flows. And those leaders who are intentional, right? They're intentional from who they invite. They're intentional about what they talk about. They're intentional about leveraging silence or seating locations or using Google Docs. But they're just thoughtful about the experience. They recognize that they're a steward, and they want people to come to that meeting, but also leave that meeting feeling that their time was valued.
I totally understand this. I remember going from when we got a new boss, the old boss, we would have the meeting where all the department heads would get together, and I was one of these heads. So we'd get together, and we didn't know what was going to happen, right? So you just go in, like, we never knew what was going to be said or done in the meeting or really when it was going to end. So we all go in, and who knows? He might tell a story from his younger days in the business. We might talk about something somebody's doing. We had no idea. And then when we got a new boss, we had this like actual plan of action for every meeting. We all had we all knew what we were going to say, what we were going to bring ahead of time. And then when we were finished, we got up and left, and it really blew my mind that you could do that. And I thought about that. I thought about that a lot reading your book. But the seating thing really shook me, because I was like, whoa, okay, that's something that's important too. People sitting at the head of the table will speak the most. People sitting next to each other will disagree the least. But if you sit across from somebody, you will disagree the most. And people who can sit next to the leader will probably contribute least to the conversation, because they're like right there. So like, but you're right. People all like at school, they would always sit in the same spot every time. Like that's the spot I sit at, but I also noticed in different meetings, you had different spots, but you would always sit in the same spot for that meeting, even if it was in the same room. Totally weird. People are so weird.
It's funny.
But you recommend not just mixing up the seating arrangement from time to time, but you also talk a little bit about walking meetings and standing meetings. So if you could talk about those two briefly.
Sure. Again, it plays into this theme that we have lots of options as meeting leaders. And stand-up meetings are one of those things that the research shows they tend to produce the same outcomes as sitting down meetings, but in nearly half as much time.
Wow.
And so those speedy meetings are prime candidates for a standing meeting. And then walking meetings, it's another nice option. Walking meetings for, just two or three people, perhaps a supervisor meeting with her or his subordinate, and they take a walk. The ratings of those walking meetings also tend to be quite favorable. People reporting some more additional creativity and focus. Clearly, you can't multitask when you're having a walking meeting. But, when you do have a walking meeting, there are some important rules of thumb. First of all, you need to tell people in advance about the walking meeting so they can wear the right shoes. You need to keep it small. You need to think through your route. And then you could even think about leveraging some technologies, such as there are all kinds of nice apps that allow you to take notes with your voice, and then those become your meeting minutes. So you can still have kind of an accounting for what was discussed. But all these, there's not one of these things that is the best choice, but all of these things are choices, and they're all helpful choices. And so when you think about this book, it really presents, you know, so many different tools and tactics and approaches. And what I want a leader to do is just to decide what fits them, what fits their culture, and what fits their team.
Yeah, and to actually make an effort. Like, you know, this I do, you know, this is not usually the typical kind of book that I usually have on the show, because it's very like it's almost an instruction manual. It's a very business related book, but I love the idea. To me, it feels like the most important thing to me is that you are advocating science for meetings. I mean, you want people to like use what we've learned from research to adjust a thing that we all have to deal with. And I love the idea of that, whether from in every aspect of life. And I love the idea that you are a scientist who studies this very important part of our lives, and that it is something that is quantified and studied and there's evidence for it. And I think that anyone who's listened to our interview, we've only really touched on a few tiny things here and there. I have the book in front of me right now, and there is a giant portion in the back where you, it's not just like, you know, you get these books that will tell you, a lot of times books like these will just give you all this information and say, now go talk to people about this at a dinner party, right? But yours actually says, all throughout it, you have an example agenda that you could use as a template. In the back, you have all these graphs and templates and tools for people to, and checklists for people to actually create better meetings and better agendas and better all sorts of things with pre-created templates for them to fill out on their own using the information in the book so that they can make it be exactly what they need for their organization. That's super cool, man.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, it's, again, my motivation is clear. I really just wanted to try to help folks out with a extremely vexing challenge that people are experiencing. And it's not, for me, it's not about my next book. It's about, you know, trying to honor the science that informed this book.
I thank you so much. By way of leaving, just if people want to keep up with what you're doing, how can they do that?
Great. They should definitely visit my website. And so it's called thesurprisingscience.com. Again, thesurprisingscience.com. Mm-hmm. And I have all kinds of information on there. I have free resources. I have, you know, other materials. So definitely I'd love for people to check that out and to be part of that community.
Oh, that sounds great. And are you on social media in any way?
I am. So I have a very large LinkedIn presence. So that, definitely reach out on LinkedIn, and then on Twitter as well. And on Twitter, it's just at Steven Rogelberg. And the nice thing about my last name is that there's almost no one out there with it. So it's kind of an unusual last name. And so it's just Rogelberg. So yeah, come, please connect.
All right. Thank you so much for this. This has really been great. And thanks for working with me on the timing of it. And being patient with it. And this has been an absolute delight, and I wish you the best.
Cool. Well, I'm very happy to be there on your show, and also really appreciate you supporting science like this.
Oh, it's all I care about, man. It's my number one mission in life. So I really appreciate when people do science-based, evidence-based medicine, evidence-based meetings. The idea that we can have evidence-based stuff is is very appealing to me. Even
awesome.
That's really cool. So, like I said, when your book came down the line, I was like, now what is this all about? And, you know, you're so used to these books being pop science, but when they're actually written by the scientist, that's a completely different thing. And I really, cool. I really appreciate it.
Nice. All right. Well, have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. For links to everything that we talked about on this episode, go to youarenotsosmart.com. There you'll find links to the previous episodes, show notes for all the shows, transcripts, all sorts of things. You can find my books. Oh my God, that's right. I have books and I never really say that on the show, but you can also find You Are Not So Smart and You Are Now Less Dumb anywhere they sell books. So yeah, we have something called a Facebook page, that is Facebook/YouAreNotSoSmart. Twitter is NotSmartBlog, @NotSmartBlog. I am @DavidMcRaney. If you'd like to pitch in and help the show out, you can go to Patreon. Pitching in at any amount will get you the show with no advertising. But if you pitch in at higher amounts, you can get t-shirts and signed books and all sorts of other crazy things. go to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart to learn more. There's also a YouTube channel. You can listen to previous episodes of the podcast there. You can also watch the live show in New York in its entirety over there at YouTube. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. The interstitial music is by Incompetech. And this music is by Banjo Apocalypse.